Okay. Let's see. There's still people wandering in, but maybe I'll just give a little bit of introduction. So we're going to have first a presentation by Evelina Domnich and Dimitri Gelfand. And then after that will be Robert. And so we'll have one presentation, then another, and I think then we'll take the questions. Or have a little talk and then take the questions. So as a bit of a background, giving people more time to wander in as well. Born in Minsk, Evelina Domnich is an installation artist whose practice is dedicated to the use of unstable media and to questions of perception and perpetuity. She received an MA in philosophy from Belarus State University and went on to join forces with Russian artist Dimitri Gelfand, who was born in St. Petersburg in 1974 and received a bachelor's degree in film and video from New York University in 1996. They're currently based in Amsterdam. The deep-rooted and long-standing collaboration between Domnich and Gelfand has, since its inception, carried out the vision of creating sensory immersion environments that merge physics, chemistry, and computer science with uncanny philosophical practices. As products of a dismissal of the use of recording and fixative media, Domnich and Gelfand's installations present an ever-transforming phenomena for observation over extended periods of time. Because these rarely seen phenomena take place live and unmediated, they often vastly extend the observer's sensory repertoire. The immediacy of this experience allows us to transcend an illusory distinction between scientific discovery and perceptual expansion. They've collaborated with numerous scientific research facilities, including the Drittes Physikalische Institut at Göttingen, the Institute for Advanced Sciences and Technologies in Japan, Rixo Lab in Russia, and Maurice Institute in Belgium. They are recipients of the Japan Media Arts Excellent Prize and Ars Electronica Honorary Mention. In Evelina Domnich and Dimitri Gelfand's Force Field, acoustically levitated water droplets resonate, vaporize, and reassemble into spheroids, toroids, and oscillating polygons while spinning nearly devoid of shear. As the droplets are transformed into different geometries, they reveal the three-dimensional shape of sound and point the observer to the rotational dynamics of celestial and subatomic bodies. The vibrations of the drops are simultaneously reverse translated into sound so that the elusive physicality of the water shapes becomes audible. So thank you for coming here and being here today.
Thank you for this beautiful introduction. And it's always a great pleasure to come to Berlin and to perform in this wonderful place, Haus der Kultur in der Welt. Yes, we'll talk about a series of works today that all involve levitation. And Dimitri and I, by far not the techno fetishists, and we are very happy that techno clank are becoming more and more wet, that you could also see on the example of the previous talk. So, yes, very often when we do the piece with acoustic levitation, people ask us if we can upscale the phenomenon, if we can levitate heavier and heavier bodies. And our fascination with levitation or kind of undermining gravity comes from realization that most of the universe does not experience gravity, and gravity is a very local phenomenon. So on Earth, it's very different from the moon or the sun. And as you go deeper in the micro world to the level of cells or molecules, the force of gravity does not work there either. So let's say 400 kilometers away from Earth's surface and a little bit deep into your body in the cells, that there is effectively no gravity. However, levitating here on Earth, big objects like, for example, this table is a pretty ridiculous claim. And this kind of fascination is not very new. So this is an example that, you know, we didn't find in a book on art history. We found this vase in Italy in a small museum in Paestum. And of course, no one knows what it is, what is depicted there. And in no other museum we found similar, let's say, plot to be depicted on a Greek vase, but it's about 2,000 years old, this vase. And since we worked with acoustic levitation, it is very reminiscent to us of a standing wave that is used to levitate something. And this is just a close-up. So you can see that the distance between whatever these objects are is equal. And this is one of the main principles of the acoustic levitation that we use in force field. So we create a standing wave between a transducer or a speaker and a reflective surface. And the most important part of it is that the half wavelengths of a wave, of a sound wave, feeds an equal amount of time between the transducer and reflector. And here is an work by Kazimir Malevich, who is a great inspiration of us, who, you know, before the age of space exploration, his suprematist compositions depict objects devoid of gravity.
Approximately 100 years ago, Kazimir Malevich claimed that the future of art will consist of apportioning weight within systems of weightlessness. Not only was Malevich alluding to the not-so-distant space age, he was referring to an utterly radical reassessment of space itself in tune with the quantum revolution, the emergence of the theory of relativity, and Edmund Husserl's rigorous philosophy. Philosophy as rigorous as science itself. This is a kind of space characterized by non-locality, objectlessness, comprised of waves and fields, as opposed to nodal points.
And this is another work by Malevich that is at the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam, where we live. So sometimes we have a chance to see it displayed, and when shown to a quantum physicist, the reaction is like, wow, this is too much. The picture is much simpler, but you can see this kind of absence of gravity and totally different force fields working in this picture. And indeed, it was mentioned that Dmitry and myself were working on this intersection of philosophy, science, and human knowledge. So it is very important for us. Of course, I was influenced by my education in philosophy and looking at science as a kind of continuation of this more rigorous approach to how you describe reality and look at it. And then, of course, comes into play Edmund Husserl criticizing philosophy and psychology of 100 years ago as being not rigorous enough and not putting enough constraints on its own method. And another great influence and inspiration is Hermann Weyl, a German physicist and mathematician who was a student of Husserl and who was also very much interested in these questions about foundations of mathematics, about the nature of space-time. And of course, what is space and time was considered by philosophy in the past as a subject, and today physics gives much more outlandish answer to this question than philosophy ever imagined. And Hermann Weyl, he seeded some of the very important developments in 20th century physics by trying to connect the notion of space-time proposed to proposed by Einstein with the theory of electromagnetism, for example, which gave rise to such ideas as unified theory in physics and string theory.
And phenomenology. Phenomenology actually is, although it went out of fashion very quickly in philosophical circles, being far too rigorous for the likes of philosophers, it's actually a very common term in theoretical physics. It's a kind of a philosophical bridge between experimental physics and theoretical physics, where you don't have perhaps the proper measurements, or you can't get any measurements at all, or the model in no way corresponds to existing theories. There's a method known as phenomenology, which tries to interpret the phenomena in ways that might build up later into a theory.
So the reason we gave you this philosophical and kind of more general preamble is, when you look at what we do, you keep in mind these questions about space-time, what is space, what is time, how these very basic forces, electromagnetic forces, which are in case of force field, when we cancel the force of gravity by counterbalancing with sonic pressure, what we have in play is this forces holding the molecule together, these forces of surface tension, which are basically electromagnetic, and so how this much more subtle forces shape and interact with space-time. All very, very difficult questions to entertain. So Hekave is a very special place for us, because we performed here on the main stage all three of our levitation works, the first one of which was Sonolevitation, and you see a picture here. And the previous one was the one taken at the stage here in Berlin, in this very same building, at the opening of Transmediale in 2007. So 2009, I'm sorry.
This was born in 2000.
So this piece is much more simple than what we showed yesterday. So you basically need much, much, much less power, because here you see below is a transducer and just a piece of metal reflector above. And as I mentioned before, the whole number of times half wavelengths has to fit. And sometimes we are asked, do we change the frequency during the performance of sonolevitation or force field? And no, we do not change the frequency. We only change amplitude or the amount of acoustic pressure, because if we were to change the frequency, the wavelengths will change and we have to adapt the height of the reflector. And so even if you know, one millimeter change, the levitation will not happen.
The piece is also an accidental homage to Eve Klein, who his only piece of music was called Monotone Symphony, which was supposed to levitate the audience.
Symphony, Monotone Silence. And we just were at the Centre Pompidou, where in Paris we ran into Robert looking at works of Zimoun. And Centre Pompidou just did this series of artworks displayed in their collection talking about synesthesia or multimodal perception of sound, vision, because of course they always want to claim that they have the artists who were first in this domain. But they displayed the score of Eve Klein. I've seen it for the first time, where I think it's for an orchestra of many more, like 40 to 50 musicians. And this piece was performed by a chamber orchestra at this very famous gallery happening, where naked models were painting their bodies in blue, in Eve Klein blue, and, you know, made imprints on paper. And the chamber orchestra at this moment was playing this Monotone Symphony, which is a single sound, single note musical piece that, in the words of Eve Klein, was supposed to levitate the listener. And And actually, we were pointed by Stephen Kovach on this parallel in our work to the work of Yves Klein, that it's quite amazing how artists had this kind of, I mean, maybe he knew about acoustic levitation. I don't know. Acoustic levitation is known since 19th century.
Well, that's a very big question. There are legends that Tibetan monks engage in some form of acoustic levitation. As far as the physics literature is concerned, it's from the beginning of the 20th century, yes. But as we were working with acoustic levitation, we came upon this paper where an oil droplet is levitated and a laser is pointed into that droplet, which in a state of maximum sphericity actually turns into an optical resonator. The laser beam gets amplified when it comes out. And this is actually based on something that we're probably more familiar with in the domain of acoustics, something that is known as whispering gallery modes. Perhaps you might have found yourself in a Gothic cathedral and you hear from 100 meters away the voice of someone in the church, as though it is right in front of your ears, because as the sound bounces across a parabolic surface, it doesn't lose any amplitude whatsoever. And in some cases, such as in this case here, purely optically, it can actually even gain intensity.
So this standing wave, you can see here the radius. So it's again about the interaction of space and the nature of space with this forces, with this force field. So just like in this example of a standing wave being appearing between the transducer and a reflector, if the sphere is perfectly spherical, the radius of the sphere will fit six times perfectly inside around the circumference, so the sphere itself becomes this standing wave resonator. And of course, all the droplets of liquid on Earth have this very particular elongated shape, the droplet shape. So the droplet of water is never perfectly spherical on Earth unless you levitate it.
So, those experiments led to a piece that we also performed here
at the beginning of 100 Years of Now project, which is also quite dear to our heart because we quoted this kind of influences of exactly what was happening 100 years ago in phenomenology, in quantum physics, in philosophy, and also in science, and in the work of Kazimir Malevich, that was all trying to find this unity of knowledge, perception, experience.
So here we see a rather different kind of acoustic levitation. There is a bath of silicon oil that is sonicated from below, and droplets of that very same silicon oil are deposited onto the bath, and they refuse to coalesce with the bath. They hover on this air-oil interface that is being acoustically generated.
So the water pushes the silicon oil pushes the air, and this air prevents the droplet from coalescing. And in this particular work, we do change frequency. And we were quite lucky that this phenomenon that was discovered in the 21st century, and like many other scientific research topics, doesn't have any practical application. So we love to work with things like that. And this phenomenon happens in a very particular frequency range, from 75 hertz to about 25 hertz. And it's quite lucky because it's a humanly audible range, and we were able to create a sort of, not exactly composition, but just program the speaker on which the oil petri dish is placed to go through these different frequencies during the performance. And you can see it in the lattices. So as you go from higher frequencies to lower frequencies, the spacing between the droplets grows. So if at 75 hertz, they're very tightly packed. So this is, let's say, around 70, because this valley of a sound wave, that's where the droplet will kind of roll into and will keep bouncing in this valley. And as the wavelengths increases and with lower frequencies, the spacing between the valleys is much bigger. And you can observe all these very subtle acoustic events with your own eyes.
Do we have enough time to watch a very brief video of this?
Yes.
That's the wrong video.
So little did we know when we started this work that some researchers in Paris were looking at the systems and performing double slit experiments with these Walker droplets. And you can do this experiment with various liquids, and silicon oil is it comes in a whole spectrum of viscosities, so the higher viscosity is, of course, better for this. So if the silicon is more viscous than water, the droplets are more stable. But the interesting thing about this system, it was the biggest, the most massive analog of quantum behavior. So when double slit experiment was performed with a Walker droplet, the droplet was behaving as a wave and as a particle, and it also displayed quantized orbits and past memory. So for example, if you bounce a droplet and then you change the phase of a wave, it will start moving backward in exactly the same way that, so it will repeat its own motions kind of backwards. So this is what called past memory for elementary particles. And it was quite fascinating. And these droplets are about 2 millimeters in diameter, so they're very tiny, but you can still see them with your own eye. And I presume that you all know about the double slit experiment that was first performed with photons of light, just with a candle, by Thomas Young in 1800. And so it was first performed with photons that proved to behave as waves and later as particles as well. And then it was performed with electrons in the 20th century, and electrons have mass. Then it was performed with fullerenes, so with very big 60 atom carbon molecules, and this is the biggest macroscopic object that in various experimental settings can perform both as a wave and a particle. And in a way, it's not surprising because we are providing the acoustic wave from below.
So photonic wind is was our next investigation of being able to levitate matter, in this case purely optically, with a laser beam. It is a phenomenon known as photophoresis, the capacity to navigate and propel matter with light. In fact, in recent years, it has been proposed as the means by which planetesimals, the seeds of planets form, because if you can imagine cosmic dust gradually snowballing into enough of a nucleus to become a planet, this is something that happens obviously before any kind of gravitational forces can help this formation take place.
And this phenomenon on here on Earth, again, can only be observed in a vacuum chamber, luckily not with a very high vacuum, so just taking most air will do. Otherwise, all the motions from air molecules, they are too strong, and the optical pressure of light will not be enough to move particles. And in this case, we were levitating diamond microparticles, so diamond is quite a dense and heavy material. Of course, you can imagine
how... But it's highly reflective. That's why we used it.
So as we are running out of time, maybe we assume that most of you have seen force field yesterday. So,
Very briefly, we're looking at droplets of water that are being acoustically levitated, and we are also given access to all kinds of exotic physical phenomena. To which we have absolutely no tangible recourse, such as the behavior of spinning atomic nuclei, and, for example, also active black holes, which are also rotating. Apparently, just like the droplets that you see here, they encounter modes of what is known as sectorial oscillation. They break up into these lobes that allow us to get a much clearer notion of what is surface tension. With respect to black holes, for example, the idea of an event horizon is very difficult for us to imagine. However, when equated to the oscillating surfaces of a spinning water droplet, we have this sensorial access to the way in which potentially these far-off domains behave.
And here you can see the kind of evaporation from the droplet upon the action of extra acoustic pressure, which is also analogous to black hole evaporation. At least that's what we would like to imagine. And perceiving this work, you travel between these very different scales, because you see it magnified dramatically on a video screen in a live video feed. And in reality, the object is tiny. It's from 2 to 7 millimeters in diameter. So although you can see it with your eyes very well, but to see all this intensity and fast speed of surface movements is very difficult with the naked eye. It's much easier to see magnified on the video screen. But nonetheless, it is not less amazing to see it with your own eyes, where all speeds are much, much faster than what you perceive on the video. And this is a installation version of this piece that we created for an exhibition in Nantes. So you see an inflatable 6-meter sphere that had 18 slits for your head to go inside. So the visitors would watch the 360-degree video inside. And actually, we wanted to put the levitator in the center of the sphere. So you, and the video that you see is the work of computational artist Paul Prudence, who created this simulation of light traveling through sonicated, vibrated water droplet. So you see this magnified, and you can imagine that your tiny body, just like part of your body, the head, is inside of this quivering water droplet. But, and the very last in the series of levitation works is the electrodynamic levitation, which is an extremely amazing area of research that is connected with quantum computing. So it uses an ion trap, a device that allowed for the first time to isolate individual atoms. And this was happening in the 1950s. And of course, the people who developed it received the Nobel Prize, and it had a tremendous impact on quantum physics. So here in the electric field, in the quadrupolar electric field, so it's not two electric poles, but four, the charged, electrostatically charged particles, in this case, like a podium spores, but you can do it with an ion, with a single atom, you can trap these particles, and the force of gravity is counteracted by the force of the electric field, and the particle will trace the behavior of an electric field, which is a very fascinating topic in and of itself, the one that Weil wrote so much about.